Penguin Random House Audio presents The Liberators by E.J. Cole. Read for you by Janet Song, Inte Kim, Greta Jung, and Raymond J. Lee. For Borders, Real and Imaginary. Part 1. Invisible Lines, 1980 to 1983.
Chapter 1. Johan, Daejeon, 1980. By an early age, I could read and write in 6 languages. I found a tool, an ink brush, a twig, or my stub finger, and used it to draw a character on parchment, dirt, or air. When one line touched another, my heart reached my fingertips to impart meaning. At 5, it was for pleasure that I left words all over town. On a tree, I carved tree. In the river, I spelled river in pebbles. On my mother's dress, I inked dress. At some point, my mother set me down and didn't pick me up again. On my mother's grave, I wrote grave. I was just a boy at the end of Japanese colonial rule. I wrote my words as if I couldn't live without them, as if I were made of nothing but words. I classed rock, plant, animal, man, and God. I observed a patch of weeds, and then myself in the mirror to see the differences between plant and man. Between them was a middle point, or animal. I asked what stood between man and God, but the grave said nothing. I watched the country divided up as spoils of war. When I was 15, I was taken in for vandalism and sent to the military. I labeled my boots, boots, and my gun, gun. I spelled fire with sticks, lit it up in flames. Penned grenade, pulled the ring. My last words I wrote on the side of an ICU tent, filled with my dismembered comrades in the blood I owed them. Death, death, death. After my years in the military, I was made of silence. I carried out my duties quickly and without protest. Peeled out the bunks, torn and stiff, and myself, thirsty and whiskered. I worked the sprawl search and rescue. Leashed the dogs, unspooled rope, baked bodies, collected resin for fuel tanks, plunged drills down holes, poked at slugs with my rifle. One day, the older recruits marched me to the showers and told me to get prim. I accepted 2 medals for protecting foreign dignitaries. My director and department were shocked to hear I wanted to retire to a lowly auditor at the age of 24. They were puzzled by my decision. But after a room full of handshakes, after I'd surrendered my clothes for the next soldier, my leaky and clouded binoculars, and a tin of hand-rolled cigarettes, I was installed in Daejeon as the youngest superior at the office. I so assumed my position, nobody called me again. I never asked what wonders I might have been capable of had I been left as the boy filled with words, or whether foreign dignitaries might have come from across the ocean to witness how I read and wrote throughout fall, winter, spring, and summer. I pictured my mother outside my room, telling visitors not to wake me, since I needed my rest. And myself, stirring up with a smile before I snuggled back into the covers. I didn't regret that she had died before the surrender, since she had not lived to see the war. Rather than words, using them whenever it snowed or rained or blossomed or the sun touched me on my way to the office, I grew skilled in courting. It didn't come easy, but I understood courting fundamentally. Courting was forcing a thing to become unlike itself. I had become removed from my own nature, so I married and had a daughter. I changed the structure of myself, an animal into a man, to love my wife. Then only life could change what God intended to be human into an animal, even into a plant, vulnerable to the crush of a heel or an aneurysm, to replace a rock in the ground with my wife, then my wife with a gravestone on the surface. One morning in 1980, I was in my mid-40s when I picked up the phone and called my employee. At 23, my daughter was one of few unmatched girls her age, and my employee had two sons who wanted to build airplanes. His sons sketched planes on their napkins, a perfect tea set of aeronautical engineers. I rang from the guest room on the first floor, my late wife's room. The windows overlooked the steps to the entrance, where tall iron gates jostled in the wind. The fog drew rose finches, like blooms in the low bush, whose cries I mistook for rainfall. On the news, threats loomed. They argued about the North Korean underground tunnels. The third tunnel had been found some years earlier, less than 30 miles from the capital. Tunnels ignited fears about spies hiding among us. GIs left their bases and camptown brothels in such numbers since the war and arrived with the train's pipe organ whistles. My employee answered with a smile in his voice. He said my daughter was a beauty, but she was the spitting image of her mother, who died from heartbreak. I said it was an aneurysm. He suspected it was the same thing. I was certain he meant no harm. My employee said it was natural that I wanted my daughter married so I could bring another woman into the home. I would need a girlfriend soon. By the time I recognized his meaning, enough time had passed to make my silence inappropriate. I thought carefully of what to say. A widower feels a widow's sorrow. My employee agreed that it must be lonely living with my daughter. He encouraged me to do what was in my best interest, like the Americans. I bargained for his youngest son. My employee said his wife wouldn't agree to it. She thought it too early for me to marry again. He'd rather talk about the riots and the spies from the north. After the phone call, I was discouraged enough to give up. But my late wife, Namjo, had told me it could be one man who turned our lives around. And wasn't that man also looking for us? My daughter's room was empty. On the dining table, rice and soup bowls. Two pale moons left under the lacework of a cover sewn by my late wife. I dug through my phone book, finding the matchmaker's number. She'd have no qualms because this was her business. But she, too, answered with a gripe. She said there should be a line of suitors out the door, but everyone was paranoid. Without peace in this country, what could we do but find peace in our homes? People would forgive me about my wife, but I better move out of the house because my son-in-law couldn't go into the kitchen without goosebumps. A house with a heartbroken woman, she said, can never be a home. That afternoon I felt unwell and boiled water for tea. Why couldn't they invite us over for dinner and pull me aside and say I'd raised a good family? The problems with my choices could wait, but Namjo had asked me to secure a better home for our daughter. The drawers hid their knives, the drain filled with hair. Shadows of lilac stems crossed the room, so polite they could shut the door behind them. The floor pulsed with dust caught in the broad light. Namjo had always worn green, her ribbons like curling leaf tips. It brought me such memories. Then a sharp whistle on the stove. Curfew was 2 hours past. I switched on the television for the noise. It wasn't enough to drown out the voice of my late wife. How can Eunsuk show her face to her classmates and teachers? I didn't know, so I raised the volume. The news was censored. Nothing but a statement about a civil commotion. The protesters looked about Eunsuk's age. We all grew up in one house and died in one house. That's normal. You can't buy a new house every time somebody croaks. I thought my wife would have liked a new house, away from everyone. On the television, I spotted my employee's youngest son. His school ID hung around his neck. They talk like that because I'm dead. Johan, when you're dead, they won't remember the awful things they said to you. The student protesters had been lined up. Why are they...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?